I always say this when I do a reading and I introduce the book, but the International Department, the Anne Frank House, you know, they go from one project to the next project to the next project to the next project, and that's how it's been for 30 years. My great close friend and colleague is about to retire next year, who really sort of built that international program. Let me turn my phone off. And he's going to retire. So I really just felt that... I really just felt that someone had to write the story. Someone had to write the story. Oh God, there's something. Okay. I really felt that someone had to write the story. And, you know, no one had actually done it. I was hearing all these stories from like over 30 years, and someone just had to put them all together before it was all lost. Because as I say, my colleagues have been my colleagues for 30 years, so they're all kind of coming up to retirement. And I just didn't want it all to be dissipated. Because,
absolutely. Yeah, and it reminds me, you know, of sort of the impetus for the project that we're currently working on. You know, my museum director, Catherine Lewis, was at Kennesaw State University back in 2003 when they took the Anne Frank in the World exhibit, and it was the first location in the Southeast. Specifically, they were looking for somewhere to take it within Georgia, South Carolina, Alabama, that area. And
what year was that, Adina?
It was 2003. And the exhibit stayed in our museum. We had actually a space purpose built for it for 3 years, and then it moved on. And there is a copy of Anne Frank in the World that is seemingly permanently on display at the Georgia Commission on the Holocaust, which has offices in Sandy Springs.
Sandy Springs, that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because I was in Atlanta last year. I was speaking at the Atlanta Jewish Book Festival, mm-hmm. and we tried to get hold, I was with my colleague from the Anne Frank Center, and we tried to get hold of the woman that runs that display at Sandy Springs, because we were staying just not a million miles away.
Right.
Yale Springs. It was just a couple of stops on the train, and I really wanted to go and see it. And it'd be nostalgic for me because Anne Frank in the World was the exhibition I cut my teeth on.
Absolutely.
Of its time. You know, it was of its time, black and white and very big. I wanted to see it in situ again. So is it still on show there?
It is. And I don't know what their particular status is at this moment with the pandemic and everything, but mm-hmm. they have it on display in their offices, and it's open to the public. And as far as I know, they don't have any intention of taking it off display until they move to a new location, which that's also...
I believe they're fundraising for that as
well. They are. So there's, you know, like everything, there's a lot of discussion about who's best situated to do what in the world of Holocaust commemoration. And in Atlanta, in the metro area, there is also the Bremen Museum of Jewish Heritage, which has its own Holocaust exhibit, and our museum at Kennesaw State. And we have a permanent Holocaust exhibit as well as a body of traveling exhibits that we've produced. Mm. So the exhibit world is, you know, there are a lot of available resources, but there's a lot of education that needs to be done, and in multiple
for sure.
ways.
That's
so
sure.
Before we get too far down this road, would it be all right if I just recorded the sort of introduction to our conversation so that that's
yes.
on the...
Can I just ask you, I just must very quickly return this call.
Sure.
It's someone I need to speak to.
So today is Tuesday, August 11th, 2020, and I'm here on Zoom on behalf of Kennesaw State University with Jillian Perry. And we will be recording a legacy series interview focused on her career, but especially as it relates to commemorating the life and legacy of Anne Frank. So could you please begin by stating your full name?
Jillian Karen Perry. sometimes known as Gillian Warnes Perry.
And do you agree to this interview?
Most certainly.
Wonderful, thank you. So could you please start by telling me when and where you were born?
Oh, shouldn't ask a woman her age. I was born in London in 1951.
And how would you characterize your youth and early education?
I was a child of the 1950s, post-war England. And when I think about my childhood, I think of it in black and white. And I think that was possibly because cars were all black in those days. So we didn't have the vivacity of colour on our streets and our surroundings that we do now. Although I must say, we lived in a house where my father took incredible pride in his back garden. So we had lovely flowers throughout the summer. And I do remember beautiful summers starting from May, which was my birthday, where we would have birthday parties in the garden. I come from a large family on my father's side who were Polish immigrants at around 1910, 1911. And the cousins are still all very close. So we've got cousins in America as well. My grandfather's brother, my grandfather came to London. His brother went on to New York. And sadly, they only ever met once in the rest of their lives. And it's quite telling because their grandchildren and children are on constant social media contact every single day. And I often wonder, I actually had a meeting at Facebook in Silicon Valley last year. And I said to the director of communications, I just often wonder what our grandparents would say who only ever saw each other once after they emigrated as young men, if they knew that their descendants were in constant social media contact. Very exciting.
Absolutely. So was religious identity important in your family?
It was very important. Yes. Not necessarily from an Orthodox point of view. My family followed the traditions and the holidays. But interestingly, and I say this to a lot of my Jewish friends, interestingly, my Polish grandmother insisted on having us all over on Christmas Day and having a Christmas tree. And one of my uncles would dress as Father Christmas. And so we enjoyed, I guess, the best of both worlds because we felt a very Jewish family. But we also enjoyed everything else that was going on around us in our society.
Did you know a lot of other Jewish families and also a lot of non-Jewish families?
Yes. Oh, yes, yes, yes. I mean, my brother and I went to non-Jewish schools. We went to a church, Church of England school, which was actually mainly populated by Jewish kids. And so, yes, we felt very, very assimilated. We obviously played with all the kids in our street because in those days you didn't sit in front of a computer all day like my grandson does. We were thrown out into the street in the morning by my mom, and we weren't expected to come step over the doorstep until it was lunchtime. And then we were thrown out again for the rest of the afternoon because she had her chores, she had her housework to do.
So when did you first learn about the events of the Holocaust?
During my childhood, there was kind of whisperings going on between adult family members. And even as a child, I kind of picked up that there had been a great catastrophe which affected our family, none of our close family, but sort of distant cousins of my grandparents. In the sort of middle to late 1950s, I don't recall when it was, my grandparents wanted my father, who was the youngest son, they were a large group of siblings, but he was the youngest son, to go on a trip to Poland to see if he could find any remnants of the Polish family. And he was willing to do that. But my mother put her foot down because she didn't want her husband to go off behind the Iron Curtain and never be seen again. So I don't think my brother did because he was 3 years younger, but I picked up those sort of whisperings about these things. And I guess the first, I heard the Diary of Anne Frank serialized on the radio, but a serialization of Anne Frank, really on just listen to the readings from her diary, didn't really contextualize how she was writing, what she was writing her diary set against. As a teenager, I read a book by a survivor called Samuel Pizarre. You may know the name. He became a famous diplomat, Frenchman. And this described in vivid details the camps. In the 1980s, I became very, very involved in the campaign for Soviet Jewry. And this was as a result of Sharansky's wife, Avital Sharansky, visiting our town not long after her husband had been sent away to the Soviet labor camp. And I'd had an interest in human rights. I had joined up our local Amnesty International group, but I found it a little bit daunting because they were taking on the human rights issues of the whole world. And I went to hear Avital speak. She came to our town at the time because we were living in a Bournemouth, which is on the south coast. And I was just so overwhelmed by what she had to say and how moving it was. And I became very involved in the campaign for Soviet Jewry. So much so that I was the leader of our very active group for 7 years. We were also a conference town. And so the political party conferences would be held in our town every year. So we got to meet people like the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, and we would always go and present them with something and thank them for their work on behalf of the Soviet Jewry campaign, particularly Margaret Thatcher. And so we really became a very active group. I visited the Soviet Union twice to take supplies and moral support to the refuseniks who were trapped in the Soviet Union. But then I became a refusenik myself 3 times because even as late as 1990, my details were still logged on the Soviet computers as an agitator. So even at that late stage, I wasn't allowed back in. And it was actually 1988 when the Soviet Jewry campaign was waning because Gorbachev was in power. And I was feeling a little bit out on a limb. My children were still small. And it was just at that point, I'd been involved in various sort of exhibitions and activities in the town. And I received a call from David Suttendorp, who was my rabbi, but also his father and Otto Frank were very great friends in Amsterdam. And it's one of these momentous calls that changes your whole life, because he said, Jilly, he said, I've heard about this traveling exhibition that's come to England from the Anne Frank House. And I would love to bring it to our town. Would you help me? And I said, oh, David, I'd love to do that. So we formed a committee. And the upshot was that 9 months later, the Anne Frank in the World exhibition, which we've just been talking about, came to a venue on the outskirts of the town. It was located in the Art College, which is now part of the very vibrant university campus. And within 3 weeks of it being on show, we had 10,000 visitors. And I thought, oh my God, this is something I really want to remain involved with. So I just got myself on a plane to Amsterdam. From London, it's only an hour. And set up a meeting with the director of the Anne Frank House and convinced him that they really needed a coordinator in the UK to continue the tour of this magical, wonderful exhibition. And so for my sins, I was appointed the British representative of the Anne Frank House and got a group of people together. And then the following year, 1990, we started forming a charity so that we could help people raise funds that were trying to bring the exhibition to their area. And so the charity became the Anne Frank Trust, started from my home, not even in London, out of London, with one part-time administrator. And that's how it all started. So that's, you know, it was, you know, that call from David saying, would I help him bring the exhibition? And the Trust is probably one of the most flourishing of the partner organizations of the Anne Frank House. When I left 4 years ago, when I retired, it had 35 members of paid staff, taking the exhibitions in really some of the most challenging areas of the UK, both sort of socially and economically. So does that answer your question?
Absolutely. And before we get into just a little bit more about the relationships among these different organizations, kind of how it all works together. So you mentioned that you had an interest in human rights and you kind of got involved in the Refusnik cause. And was there something in your education or your early life that kind of sparked you to think broadly about human rights?
What it was, and I think it's what happens to a lot of people when they have children. It was really when I had young children, I started thinking about the world and the world that they would grow up into. And so that's really what really fired my interest initially in human rights and making the world a better place. And I know just from my years when, you know, we'd had support new supporters or new trustees on the board, and you say, well, what's really got you interested in working for this cause? And they've said the same thing. Well, I've got young children and I want to try and make the world a bit better place for them. So I think really that was it. And also things like, you know, reading Holocaust literature, seeing, do you remember you must have heard of the movie, the American miniseries Holocaust that was shown in the early 1970s, which actually opened the eyes to many people, including Jewish people, about the deep impact of the Holocaust. And so there were things going on around, and I had this feeling that if my family hadn't got out there by the grace of God, and the same feeling that I got, you know, when I heard Avital Sharansky speak, she could have been me, my family could have remained behind the Iron Curtain, et cetera, et cetera. So it was very much this sort of feeling of, well, you know, I'm very comfortable and happy and leading a good life. Let's do something about the others. And I mean, it's been an incredible journey, Adina. It's just been an amazing journey that I've been privileged to be part of for 32 years, because David made that call to me in the summer of 1988, and here I am in the summer of 2020, still peddling my cause, you know.
So tell me a little bit more about then the relationship between the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam, and then the trust in the UK, and there's an international organization that travels the exhibits. I know there was more than one at this point, you know, around the world. Did most of those organizations form organically, kind of the way that yours did, or was there a concerted effort?
Yes, it's all down to people. And certainly the Anne Frank Center in the USA, which is now known as the Anne Frank Center for Mutual Respect, that evolved out of Otto Frank forming a group of people, group of people together in New York in around 1977, and they became known as the Friends of the Anne Frank House, including, I mean, on their, they had some very notable people on their letter paper, including Albert Einstein and various other people, and that evolved out of that. And again, very often it's down to one person, and in that case it was down to a Holocaust survivor called Jack Polak. You may have heard about the book and the documentary about his life and his life with his wife. If you haven't, Google Steal a Pencil for me. It's a phenomenal story. They fell in love in Bergen-Belsen, so say no more. And they both came over to America after the war and started, you know, family. And they dedicated their lives to education. He was a businessman, successful businessman in New York. And he was one of the founders of the Anne Frank Center, and it became his great passion in life. He died about 5 years ago at age 103, I think he lived to be. And his wife died similarly. I think she also made it to 100 as well, 99 or 100. So it's Steal a Pencil for me. It's absolutely phenomenal. So he was really the driving force to establish the Anne Frank Center in New York. I was the driving force to establish it in the UK, and then in our latest partner organization. So we're all sort of licensed by the Anne Frank House to carry out education in Anne's name in our relevant countries. The one of the latest ones, which I mentioned in my talk, was Argentina, the Centro Ana Frank in Buenos Aires, which opened in 2009. And again, it was a relationship between a human rights activist who was imprisoned, by the way, by the dictators in the 70s. And he was an educator as well. And again, great interest in the Holocaust. His wife is a well-known rabbi in Buenos Aires. And so, you know, it's a question of convincing the Anne Frank House that these were the people that could do it. And so that's really how those partner organizations started. There's also a partner organization in Berlin, the Anne Frank Zentrum, which have a base and a permanent exhibit on display. They do some good stuff. It's a small organization. There was one, an operation in Austria, in Vienna, the Anne Frank Vieren, but I don't think that exists anymore. So there we are. Otto Frank started the Anne Frank House in 1960, and that sprouted these partner organizations. And then you asked me also in your notes about where does the Anne Frank Fonds in Switzerland sit in all this? Well, this was something that Otto started in 1966, I believe he set it up. He'd opened the Anne Frank House in 1960, but he actually lived in Switzerland. And in the early 60s, the Anne Frank House was staffed by quite a few radicals. You may have read about it in my book, The Early Days of the Anne Frank House. And they were actually coming to blows a little bit between things that they were doing, activities they were doing, like an exhibition on apartheid in South Africa, where they equated the South African leaders with the Nazis. And Otto didn't agree with this. So they saw him as an old man that was, you know, out of the picture now. So there were some tensions. So in 1966, Otto set up a different foundation in Switzerland where he could sort of have benign control over it, that would administer the rights and royalties to the diary. So if anyone wants to do a commercial production based on Anne Frank's story, like a movie or a play or a piece of music, etc., they would have to get rights, acquire the rights from the Anne Frank Foundation in Switzerland. More recently, they've been sort of doing their own educational programs, like they have sponsored and been very involved in an exhibition at the Frankfurt Jewish Museum about the Frank family and its history, because of course the Frank family came from Frankfurt. They always say that, well, Amsterdam is, you know, the Franks didn't spend very much time in Amsterdam, but the roots of the family are in Frankfurt. So, and there's not always been the best of relations going on between the two organizations. You may have read about this. A lot of sort of conflict about who owns the rights to the artifacts, who owns the rights to the photographs. There's ongoing tension. On a personal level, they all get on because they're all doing the same thing. But on a professional level, there's a lot of tension going on there.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of the, you know, living in Atlanta, there is a very complex relationship among the various organizations that are related to the Martin Luther King family. So yes, there's the King Center and the Martin Luther King National Historic Park, you know, through the National Park Service, and they're all... Yeah. It's amazing how people who have the same basic mission, you know, things can get a little muddy when you get into the rights and reproductions and those details. Mm-hmm.
I was going to go and visit the Martin Luther King Center when I was there last year, but it was there in November. It was early November. It was so cold. I thought, I'm going to the deep south. It's going to be like Florida. It's going to be sunny. And I was freezing. So the thought of walking around a park just didn't hack it for me. So in the end, I arranged with one of the producers at CNN to go into their headquarters, and he took me on a lovely 2-hour tour of CNN.
That's a lot more comfortable. Yeah, it's a pretty windy part of town, actually, the old Fourth Ward. So tell me, take me back to the opening of this exhibit in the UK. And you mentioned that you had 30,000 people come, you know, in a relatively, 10,000, excuse me, in a short period of time. Mm-hmm. But how was it received? What was the publicity like?
Well, let's just go back a step, because this wasn't the first exhibit in the UK. My colleague Jan Erik had come and brought the exhibition to London. It was launched in London in the Mull Galleries, which are very near to Buckingham Palace, in 1986. So that was a year after it first been created in 1985. And he spent 6 months living in London and with very limited connections, because he was Dutch, trying to get a tour off the ground of the country. And he was very successful, actually. And it was really when he met me and, you know, the team in Bournemouth and saw how serious we were about this. I mean, because he was encountering a few problems that, because he wasn't British, and in his sort of enthusiasm and I guess a bit of naivety, he would go and have meetings in, say, Scotland, and he would find that the exhibition was being hijacked by radical sort of extremists who wanted to use the exhibition as a platform for peddling the Palestinian cause. So he was finding himself in sometimes a little bit of difficulty in hot water. So to have a base, to have an organization as a partner organization based in Britain, with keeping an eye on who these people were and what were their background and their politics and what their aims were for the exhibition, really worked out. And you know, with so many of these things, it's all about timing. You get the timing right when, you know, they're looking for something, the opportunity is there. It's with everything in life. So they opened the exhibition first in 1985 at the Westerkerk, which is adjacent to the Anne Frank House. It was opened by Queen Beatrix. And then a bit later, it went over to New York and the hoped for sponsors never came forward to keep it going. And it found itself languishing in a big warehouse for quite a while, and then simultaneously again in Frankfurt, the home city of the Frank family. And then Jan Erik started sort of making feelers, putting his feelers out all around the world, and as I say, the rest is history. So we operated under a license and an MOU from the Anne Frank House that our remit would be Britain and Ireland as well, because we went to places like Dublin and places in Ireland. On a personal level, I was very lucky, because occasionally the Anne Frank House would come to me and say, look, we need someone to go and speak at an opening. Would you go to South Africa? Would you go to Hong Kong? Would you go to Sao Paulo? And so I've been very lucky in that respect, that I have done openings in different places around the world. But just on a personal level, you know, we were really confined to our educational activities to Britain and Ireland.
So then this world travel of the exhibit was happening somewhat simultaneously. So while you had the license for Great Britain and Ireland, they had this international arm that was arranging for the exhibit to travel to Asia.
Yes, and being printed, the panels being printed in different languages as well. Sometimes on one exhibit, there'd be two languages. I don't know how it is in the Atlanta, the one at Sandy Springs, whether it's just English. So for example, if it would go to somewhere like Florida, they would have it in English and Spanish. But obviously if it went to somewhere like Russia, they would just have it in the Russian language. So they were busy printing different copies in different languages all the time.
And the programming that was involved in that came along with the exhibit's travels, was that left up to the individual organizers?
Yes, it usually was. We weren't prescriptive. When we first started out, for many, many years, it was a big traveling exhibit that would go to a prominent venue in the center of a city. So it'd be like the cathedral or the city hall or the art college, the art gallery or museum, somewhere very prominent. And all the schools would come in. And we relied very much on volunteers. We'd have volunteer docents. But the process was that either I would identify an area where I wanted to take it, perhaps they had some sort of social issues, some racism, some instances of racism, etc., and target the local council, the local authority, perhaps the mayor or the leader of the council, etc., and go and convince them that they wanted this project and they would pay for it. They might get some sponsorship for that. And then I would go to that area, and I used to love this, Adina, traveling around the country, walking into a room and setting up a complete new board of strangers that would each have their specific roles. So there'd be people from the education, from the equalities, from the civics teams, from the mayor's office, perhaps, from the local community representatives, the youth engagement officer, all these kind of people, bringing them all together, assigning them their tasks, the public relations and marketing departments, so that they knew they were going to get some bang for the buck from their investment. And so each one had its own sort of kind of feel. So sometimes they'd put on, for example, a dramatic production to coincide, or there'd be a conference, or there would be, the local cinema would get involved and they'd bring a load of movies that would, you know, film festival linked to it. So all kinds of things like that. But over the last sort of 15 years or so, things started to change, evolve. I steered by the international work, and you'll see it in my book, how that evolved from them first bringing this idea of peer education, which actually in the book, it describes how it started. They piloted it in the Austrian valleys in the Tyrol, and how that sort of really kind of took over. So it's not to say we don't still have big community exhibits, and like that you staged, or like that they've recently staged at the Florida Holocaust Museum. I think it was in Orlando. But when they have those exhibits now, because we've worked with teams of peer educators in schools, those kids come as ambassadors to take the public round, whereas before it was sort of more sort of elderly volunteers that had some time on their hands. They were retired. So the whole sort of way of running these exhibits has changed. And that's really was the other premise of the book, of my book, that I talked about it around the world, the impact it was having around the world in various scenarios, but also the impact, particularly on socially deprived communities where young people had very little aspiration and hope and ambition for the future, what this has left behind with them.
So what surprised you most about the way the exhibit was received in places that maybe didn't have a prior relationship to the story or a huge Jewish community? Or
yeah, you know, like the picture I showed in the seminar about Kazakhstan, those kids in Kazakhstan or Japan or Hong Kong, which I saw for myself. I think what surprises me is the diversity of the connections they have made to their own lives. So we don't come along and preach and say, this is how you've got to live your life, you've got to be nice to everyone, sort of thing. What we say is, this is what happened to this teenage girl. And let them make the connections, like I mentioned about the young people in India making connections to the iniquities of the caste system. And so it can do such a different role. I mean, there are some countries still where they're battling against human rights issues. I mentioned how careful they had to be taking that exhibition to Kazakhstan, and also going in some of these nasty countries in Latin America, in Central and Latin America, where they had to be tread very carefully. But it's just the diversity of the people, young people that they're touching. For example, the kids in Brazil, they've got different, it's a different setup from perhaps the kids in a township in South Africa, but they have things in common. You know, that they've been born into difficult circumstances, but they want to make their lives better. So the stories that it's doing, the jobs that it's doing in so many different countries of the world. I mean, even in somewhere like the United States, it can be playing a different role in some of these very impoverished schools down in southern Florida, in Miami, around there, and that it can be doing in somewhere like the plains of Iowa, so where there is little diversification of people. So it's I think I never stop being interested in how it's being used. I have to show you that on Friday I received this astonishing typed letter. I don't know if you can see it in front of the palm.
Your virtual background is actually making the letter disappear.
Okay, tell me, because I'm going to email it to you.
Okay.
This incredible letter, which was sent on to me by a publisher, by a young history teacher. And she poured her heart out to me in this three-page letter about how she'd been bought the book as a Christmas present, my book. And she read it and brought everything back to her, and how she went on this journey from being a shy, not very confident teenager, and the exhibit coming to her school. She went on as part of the Lessons from Auschwitz program to be, she was selected to go to Auschwitz, which is run by a different organization from ours. But all the things that have really taken her along this path to becoming a history teacher. And I'm going to email it to you because I think you'll find it interesting, but it's just one of many stories we've heard. We've heard from teachers who say that because through that peer education program, young people have respected their teachers more. And it's come from the kids as well. No, actually, come to think of it, no, it came from the kids themselves, that they have felt a greater empathy towards their teachers, and particularly in these, some of these rough areas, schools in rough areas, where they've been very sort of dismissive of their teachers. But being peer educators themselves and having to keep the attention of their students, they have understood the challenges that a teacher faces. But teachers have told us, very much like the letter from this girl, that it has encouraged learning about Anne Frank and how important her story is and how we live our lives today, has encouraged young people to consider taking history as their option later in their school career.
That's very inspiring. And it seems like the story resonates with people in different ways, you know, depending upon where they're living and what their personal experiences are or have been. How do you think that Anne Frank's story has been reinvented for each new generation?
Definitely. And I think that the work that we were doing, for example, in the UK in the early 1990s, very different. Waves of immigration have changed. So, for example, when I first started out, racism was something that was white on black. It was very clear cut. You very rarely saw teenagers in Muslim dress. In Islamic dress. It was a very rare phenomenon. You would see Indian people in saris, but you never see that the hijab is something that's a phenomenon that's changed over the years that I was working. You never saw young girls wearing hijabs. So cultural identity has changed. The methods we use to communicate, of course, has changed. I remember when I first started out receiving my first ever fax, and it was like, oh my God, this was like the ultimate in technology. And I had it framed on my wall for many, many years. So the way we communicate and the speed we communicate and the speed that young people want to receive information has changed. So very much things have evolved so much over the years. The dramatic interpretations of in the way Anne's story is depicted on screen. I do a lecture called Anne Frank on Film, and I compare the original George Stevens film of 1960 to, say, for example, the BBC production of The Diary of Anne Frank, which was put together in 2009, where, for example, in the George Stevens black and white film, it's all very sort of, Anne is very, it's very sentimentalised, and it very much, for, you know, the deep issues of being a Jew in the Holocaust were really not explored because those were the times. You wanted to suppress that. You just wanted to see a wartime heroine. But now, you know, we deal with those issues of what it felt like for Anne to be a Jew, and also her sexuality coming to the fore. So all these kind of issues have very much evolved and changed, certainly over the 30 years that I've been working. Society has changed so much. And probably, you know, after the pandemic, we just don't know what the world is going to look like.
So what then do you think it is about her story that resonates with so many people and in all of these different circumstances?
Because she was a teenager. She was a young girl that was sort of transitioning from childhood into adolescence. And she was going through all the things that girls and boys are going through, those uncertainties, those wondering, you know, what am I going to do with my life? Who am I going to be? Relationships with parents, relationship with her siblings, falling in and out of love, her passions, her concerns for the world. They just resonate with young people. But then, of course, the poignancy of the fact that she couldn't survive. She wasn't surviving. So although she had hope, her story isn't one of hope. But thanks to, you know, the beliefs of her father and the determination of her father, we've been able to have the hope of that story, of his hope and his hope in a better future, that education can bring a better future. So there's so many layers of the story, and the responsibility, for example, was responsibility of the helpers. Would you risk your life? Would I be the person to risk my life to save others? These are sort of universal topics.
So you mentioned that you never got to meet Otto Frank because he passed away in 1980.
8 years. Yeah, 8 years before I became involved.
But you did have the opportunity to meet Gies, and also to spend some more time with Otto's stepdaughter. Can you tell me about your meeting with Meet Gies and your kind of impression of her as a
person? Do you know something? I can't remember where I first met her, but I think it was that picture that I showed in the talk about in the Anne Frank house, because I met her so many times afterwards. And when we've taken over sort of competition winners and what have you in those days to Amsterdam, she would always come and meet with them. And of course the highlight was attending the Academy Awards with her, which was just something I'll never forget. Also, I went to her apartment in the early days. She was lovely. And I had lots of letters from her. She used to send me letters, and it was just so lovely. I particularly also remember going to the BBC with her, and she was like walking around the corridors because she was going to do a record an interview for a women's program, and she was like touching the walls and saying, "Gillian, don't you realize this was our lifeline during the war?" So she was an incredible person, and you know, really to her dying day, and she lived to be 100, she would still sigh and shake her head, you know, that she couldn't save the family. And she risked so much, even after the family were arrested. She risks so much. She tried to, you know, she raised money to try and get them to buy their freedom. But again, it was wrong timing. She went into a room where she shouldn't have been, and she was thrown out. But she tried so hard. And I think, you know, she's just such an incredible inspiration to all of us. So that was Meep. Spent wonderful times with Meep. Eva, I still spend a lot of time with, not so much now. So I haven't seen her since, January, I think. So there's a lot about Eva in the book. She's currently the president of the trust, and I'm the vice president. And so she was the co-founder with me and two other people. And so we've, you know, and every time I hear her story, and I've probably heard it about 100 times, she always brings in something different. And she has really lived her life very much in the shadow of the brother that she adored and that you know, was so cruelly taken from. She couldn't believe that this talented young boy, handsome young boy, who was a musician, he was an artist, he was a poet, would have had his life taken away. And, you know, she's always lived with that guilt.
Can you briefly summarize kind of her story? Just, I don't know that it's as familiar to folks as Meeps.
she was actually Austrian born in Vienna, and her family, after the Anschluss, escaped first to Brussels and then to Amsterdam. And again, like other German and Austrian Jewish refugees, they found themselves living in the Mervedeplein department of development of apartments. And she would play with Anne, but they weren't close buddies because they were very different in personality. Eva is admittedly, she was a tomboy and she liked to hang out with the boys and, you know, ride her bicycle and, you know, play with the boys. Whereas Anne was very much a flirtatious girl and was fascinated. She loved, her interests were fashion and Hollywood, etc. So they weren't the closest of buddies. But, you know, Eva has related to me in the book, you know, her memories of Anne. And then both families went, had to go into hiding. Eva's family was actually betrayed and they were taken in for interrogation on her birthday. On her 15th birthday of the 11th of May, 1944. And Eva spent time in Auschwitz. She wasn't moved on to Bergen-Belsen. And very, very miraculously, Eva and both Eva and her mother survived. And there are lots of stories. You can read her book all about this incredible, it wasn't easy for two people to survive together. And on the journey back to Amsterdam at a railway station when the train had stopped, Eva recognized her friend Anne's father. And she ran over to him and he pressed her for any news of his daughters. And of course she didn't have because she was in Auschwitz, they were in Bergen-Belsen. And she fleetingly introduced him to her mother. When the two families were back in Amsterdam, and they eventually found out what had happened to Eva's father and brother, and of course Otto discovered what had happened to his two daughters, they started getting together and providing each other with comfort and solace. And Eva still recalls the day that Mr. Frank came to their apartment with a little brown paper parcel, and it was Anne's diary. And so it had a lovely outcome because in 1953, Otto and Fritzi Geringer, Eva's mother, were married. So Eva had Mr. Frank as her stepdaughter, a stepfather who she absolutely adored and respected. And he became a grandfather to Eva's three daughters. Now, Eva never talked about her experiences until she happened to be at the opening of the Anne Frank exhibit in London in 1986. And the then leader of London Council, she was sitting next to him at the dinner, and she started, he said, "What's your story?" And she started telling the story. And then as all the formal proceedings were finishing, he said, "Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, Eva wants to say a few words." And she was absolutely struck dumb. You know, she'd never even discussed it with her husband, let alone her children. And so she stood up and she started speaking, and the whole thing came out. And to this date, she's never stopped. So that was 34 years ago. And she's still at the age of 91. She's still traveling the world, telling her story.
And did she feel that, how did she feel about Anne Frank's story being sort of so well known and so popular, being a survivor and sort of knowing, you know, that there's quite a diversity of people's experiences?
Well, let me tell you that she's admitted that when she was younger and Otto and her mother were alive, she got quite jealous of Anne, particularly when she was living in London and she had a miscarriage at one stage and bringing up three little daughters. And when she had the miscarriage, she actually phoned her mother in Switzerland and said, "Mama, I really need you. Come and help me look after the girls, and I'm feeling really poorly." And Fritzi said, "Oh no, I can't. Otto and I are going on a tour of such and such and such." So Eva admitted very candidly that she felt a resentment towards Anne, because Anne had kind of taken her mother away from her. But you know, as she matured, you know, that sort of abated. And you know, when she talks about Anne, you know, really, and truly when she's invited to speak all over the world, it's not because she's yet another survivor. It's because of a close connection to Anne Frank. So she realizes that and she appreciates that. And it's given her the opportunity to tell the story of her own brother.
And I think that raises a really interesting point, which is that Anne's story is something of an entry point for a lot of people. You know, it's the first Holocaust-related story that many people learn.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you have, having worked with this material, you know, for 30 plus years, do you have a sense of why that is? Why Anne Frank's story when there are so many out there?
There are so many out there, but I think it's a combination of the way that Anne wrote and articulated her deepest feelings that young people can so relate to, but also the combination of circumstances where Meep rescued the diary and gave it to Otto. Now, Otto could have made that decision never to have it published. I mean, certainly it was very difficult to get books published in post-war Netherlands. People weren't interested in looking back and learning about the horrors of the war. They wanted to move forward. So finding that publisher, and also it was very difficult even to find paper to publish the book, and you'll read the story in my book. So it was just that sort of perfect storm of circumstances that things came together with Meep and Otto, and just the way that Anne wrote and the person she was. But also one other factor is because Otto was such a keen photographer, we have this incredible collection of photographs of her growing up. And so young girls particularly can identify with this girl because sometimes she looks so contemporary in some of those photographs.
Yeah, that's, I think that is that mixture of the literary and the visual and this heroic kind of hiding the helper's story. There is something there that does seem to resonate no matter where your own circumstances lie on that continuum. Are you, you know, someone who could be a helper or who could be in danger or, you know, is a teenager?
But also boys also resonate with the going into hiding aspect. They find that very, very interesting.
Yeah. So you mentioned that, you know, there's a delicacy to sharing this story in order to motivate people to do good in the world, you know, how you define that. And that, you know, there are many ways in which causes can kind of take so much precedence that they maybe overshadow the story. Do you think that there's an appropriate balance when you're using history to inspire people to work for human rights?
Yes, I do think we've got it right. I do think that with the peer education program, we make sure that they know the facts properly, that no one's going to give out, you know, the wrong facts because it's too important. You can't have people, you know, Holocaust deniers coming down on you and saying, well, you're teaching young people, you know, lies. So you have to have, they have to know the stuff and have to know the facts before they can impart the facts. But this was very much Otto Frank's vision to bring the story into the contemporary world and really to tackle all forms of prejudice and discrimination. So it wasn't just that he wanted anti-Semitism to be explored, but he wanted all forms of persecution and discrimination to be explored through Anne's story. And so that's very much following his line and his legacy. So I think, you know, we do get it right. I mentioned to you that one of the reasons that I came on board as the British coordinator all those years ago was to ensure that the exhibition wasn't hijacked and Anne's story isn't hijacked for diverse political causes and, you know, sort of dissipated.
So is there anything I haven't asked you about, you know, that you would want to make sure that you share about your experiences working with Anne's story and multiple diverse communities around the world?
Nothing I can think of at the moment. I'm going to send you the letter so you can see, and this is one of many that we receive. And we've actually also, just going on, following on from what I was saying before, is that the Anne Frank Trust actually commissioned about 4 years ago the Department for Social Psychology at a university carried out an exploration, a proper evaluation of the impact of both on the peer educators and the young people, the peers that they were giving the story to, and how it made them look at issues of prejudice and discrimination, and also how it made the peer educators, how it impacted their lives and gave them a sense of leadership and communication and confidence, above all, that they can tackle issues. They went back to renew it a year ago, and published it at the House of Commons, actually in Parliament a year ago. And some of the people they interviewed were those that they'd interviewed 3 years previous, and how it was still impacting on their lives. And the results were quite remarkable in this, you know, very fast moving world where there were so many influences, that 3 years on, these young people were still talking about the impact it's had on their lives. And you can read that letter as well.
Oh, that's wonderful. And one thing I realized that I had was curious whether you knew, do they still do these international conferences at the Anne Frank House with young people?
They do, yes. Bringing ambassadors, Anne Frank ambassadors from all around the world. Yes, they do. Our ambassadors in the UK tend to be sort of high school students. So they tend to be age about 13, 14, 15. Because of the curriculum demands of getting them out of their classrooms, you know, when they start getting older. But the Anne Frank House tend to work with older ambassadors, late teens and early 20s. But they do certainly do hold them, and of course nothing this year, but hopefully next year they can resume that.
That's very, very neat. And is English, do you think that's the language that is still like most common for everybody who's involved in this? I mean, I know that it's been translated into hundreds of languages, I think.
Well,
at this
point, over 70. I'm not quite sure exactly what the number is at the moment, but I always say it's over 70 because when I was working, it was over 70. I'm sure it's many more now. I mean, when we all get together, for example, at the Anne Frank House for our meetings and conferences, no one ever speaks Dutch. It's all English, and English is the universal language. But it's just phenomenal to see the different languages that's been translated into.
And I'm assuming that in some of these cases, the ambassadors, the peer educators, if the exhibit comes to another, they'll speak in whatever language they're most comfortable in.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, because the exhibit, we're not talking about, that, you know, as well as the book, the exhibit will have gone in their language.
Right.
This is why, you know, for every place there's different languages. So there'll be Chinese versions and Russian versions and Polish versions and Spanish versions and whatever. They will be doing their guiding, their docenting in their own language, even Kazakhstan. So.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
I've just got a couple of things for you. I'm going to send Michaela's letter. The Anne Frank in Translation exhibit is going to be at the museum for about a year, whenever that is. But do you have plans to tour it?
We do, yeah. Good. So we have currently, I think we have about 20 different traveling exhibits that are this sort of quick screen, very portable style that we travel for free as long as
either... You send them all over the country?
Generally, if we can get it to you, if it's within our, I think it's like a 50-mile radius, it's completely no cost to any other library or school or institution. Otherwise, you only pay shipping. So we have a Japanese internment exhibit, for example, that's been very popular on the West Coast, in Seattle and other parts of Washington State, and that's just that they'll pay to ship it. And we've had an immigration exhibit that's gone to New York, that kind of thing. So they pay shipping. But beyond that, there's no cost associated with our
exhibits. Because you have generic sponsors of the museum, and this is part of the...
We are a part of the university. We have a combination, actually, of being a a unit within kind of Sauk State University, which is University System of Georgia, so state institution. We also get a fair amount of grant funding from local, you know, family charities, the Marcus Foundation, which does a lot with the Holocaust education writ large. They pay for educators on our staff who go into schools and develop programs. So everyone's looking for grants nowadays. But
is that funded by the university or by the actual museum?
Our museum is a unit within the university.
Yeah. So it's the university that funds it. Yeah. So I would like to hook you up with Dora Stevic at the University of South Carolina, because he'd be fascinated by what you're doing. And more of the Anne Frank Center programs and exhibits are finding their way down to his department.
Fascinating. Okay.
So I think you should be perhaps working together. If I can be of any help at all, just let me know.
Thank you.
Because I've had, 30 odd years of touring exhibits. So, and I think possibly you will maybe need to be in touch with the Anne Frank House, but Doyle can be a very good conduit with that because he works very closely.
And with the Anne Frank Center in the United States.
Of course, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I work with them too.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So I think that's great. Is there anything else I want to ask you? I don't think so. I think that's about it. I think it's been fantastic. And keep me posted, as they say. Mm-hmm. Have you got any of the panels sort of designed and produced yet?
Not yet. We have a preliminary design, colors and ideas. Mm-hmm. But I've been, in this stage, trying to conceptualize it as a combination of the subject matter, which I find really interesting, which is this legacy story, why is Anne Frank so well known? What processes made that possible? The combination of the saving of the diary, the publication, the translation, the creation of the Anne Frank House and these exhibits, and then also of these performance pieces, the play and the film and then the television dramas, so people's encounters with Anne Frank differed depending upon where they fell within that kind of chronology. But I'm also trying to think of this as, something that might resonate with young people, in terms of how do you leave a legacy? Are you writing something? What your observations of the world, the connections that you make? Mm-hmm. So some of the exhibits we produce, it's really easy to nail down the audience. This one I'm having a maybe slightly harder time just trying to think about because it'll open at a university, but we want it to be of interest to our usual school audience as well, which tends to be fifth grade through middle school.
I've seen the exhibit Reading and Writing with Anne Frank. It's quite a small exhibit.
I saw that was listed among the offerings, but I haven't seen it myself. So I saw it was listed on the Anne Frank House.
It can be set up in like a small library. So
I would really like to see that one because that does sound.
And the other thing is, I was going to ask you, I'm doing a course of 5 lectures for Context now, starting on the 19th. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've signed up for that one.
I have not. No,
but please do promote that to your colleagues, because it's 5 1-hour lectures, and I go into all aspects of Anne's life before they went into hiding, during hiding, the helpers and the other people in hiding, then what happened after the arrest and the betrayal leading to the Anne Frank House and its programs, and then the final one is a tour of Anne Frank's Amsterdam through her eyes.
Oh yeah.
That starts on, it's one a week on starting from August the 19th, so if you could help us promote
absolutely
that.
I will make sure that our contacts all know about that. So thank you again. I'm going to make sure, I realize I hadn't stopped the recording, so I'm going to do that now.